Psalm 139. The title of the message is The Perceiving, Pursuing, Planning Pure God. The Perceiving, Pursuing, Planning Pure God. And I think as we work our way through the psalm, you will see how that these are ways that God is exalted in this psalm. Here's one way to think about Psalm 139. If you look at that very last verse of Psalm 138, David, under the influence of the Holy Spirit, writes, "The Lord will accomplish what concerns me." That is very comforting, is it not? Yahweh will accomplish what concerns me. But David understands that though God is sovereign, in his sovereignty he has ordained means like evangelism, like gospel proclamation, like prayer. And so he prays at the end of that verse, "Do not forsake the work of thy hands." The fact that God is sovereign does not mean that we don't pray and express our dependence on him. And remember, I said to you, what David is praying there literally is, "God, don't drop." If you think of this little communion cup, and if this is you, he's saying, "Lord, don't drop the work of your hands. Lord, hold me fast." So he's comforted by God's sovereignty, but then he understands that he still needs to pray, he still needs to express himself and his dependence on the Lord, and so he prays. Well, beloved, Psalm 139 is going to fill in the gaps. In other words, to Psalm 138, in other words, Psalm 139 expands upon the truths of Psalm 138. Psalm 139 is going to explain to you why it is that God will accomplish that which concerns you, why it is that he will hold you fast and not drop you. It's going to substantiate. It's going to support with further truths, with greater detail, how it is, what it looks like for God to accomplish that which concerns you. That is then one way to think about Psalm 139. In verses 1 through 6, and we're just going to read these as we go along, you learn about the perceiving God. The perceiving God. If you like, God is all-knowing. He knows all things. Or, if you want a theological word, God is omniscient. He knows all things. Let me read the first 6 verses, and then we'll comment on them. "O Yahweh, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thoughts from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there's a word on my tongue, behold, O Yahweh, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before, and you have put your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it." So again, I say in these verses, we learn of the perceiving God, the all-knowing God. When the psalmist says in verse 1, "You have searched me," that word for search there is the word that was used to dig for precious metals or stones. Well, think about that. If you mine, you go deep. You don't mine on the surface. And so what the psalmist is informing you and I of here is that God's knowledge of us and of our lives is not superficial. It is penetrating. It is deep. It is comprehensive. So he says, you have searched me. You've sought the inner recesses of my heart and known me. And then verse 2 is emphatic. When he says you, in the original language, it's you, yes, you, or you alone. And beloved, I want to remind you at the outset that this psalm is very personal. We won't have time to highlight all the personal pronouns, the you and the me and the my, but there are over 70 personal pronouns in 24 verses. So he says, you, yes, you know. When I sit down and when I rise up. Now think about that. He's saying that God's knowledge of him, of the psalmist, extends to all the psalmist's actions of rest or activities of rest, as well as activities of motion. Think about that. Just think about yesterday. Myself, for example, I played squash in the morning. After I played a game, I sat down. When it was time for me to play the next game, I stood up. Then I went home. And I sat down at the breakfast table. I sat down at the lunch table. And I rose up from there. And I sat down in a couch. Do you know how many times you sat down and you rose up yesterday? No, you don't think about that. You take that for granted. But the psalmist is saying, if you sat and rose 20 times yesterday, God knew about that. And everything in between your times of activity and rest, God knows all things. And then he says at the end of verse 2, you understand my thought. It's the word for intentions. God even knows the motives and the intentions of our hearts. Do you begin to see that this is the perceiving God? This is the omniscient God? This is the all-knowing God? Look at verse 3. You scrutinize. That's an interesting word. It's the word to winnow, or if you like, to sift. In those days, they would winnow chaff. You would separate the chaff from the wheat, the good from the bad. Or if you think about, maybe not so much in our day, but perhaps a few decades ago, I'm not sure, I haven't kept up with mining practices, but perhaps they still do it. But if you were to mine a river, for example, and if you were to gather the sand from the riverbed, and so you would have rocks, right, and small pebbles perhaps, and then you would have diamonds or precious stones, and you would sift that to separate the precious stones or the diamonds from that which is just regular, common stones. And the psalmist is saying that this is what God does. Notice, you scrutinize, you know the wheat and the chaff of my day, you know the good and the bad of my path. That is a metaphor for your life, for your activity, for your behavior, as well as my lying down. God, you know when I leave for work, and you know when I get back from work, and when I lay down at night to rest my head on the pillow. In fact, he says at the end of verse 3, you are intimately acquainted with all my ways. God knows everything about you, everything about your life, everything about your day, everything about the good in your life and the bad in your life. The blessings and what's not so pleasant or good or beneficial. Now, in case you wonder to what degree this extends, look at verse 4. Even before there's a word on my tongue, behold, O Yahweh, you know it all. How can that be? Well, remember I said to you that thought, there's the word for intention or motive. And what does the Bible say? The mouth speaks from that which fills the what? The heart. God knows what's in your heart before it comes out of your mouth. And so he knows before there's even a word on your tongue. Before you hear what you say and before the ears hear what you say, God knows what you're going to say. And then look at verse 5. You have enclosed me behind and before. Again, the Hebrew language is so graphic, we miss out sometimes on the English because we just don't convey the thought as graphically and as picturesque as the Hebrew. But that word there for enclosed was used of a city that was besieged. A city that was surrounded by enemy forces. And so what the psalmist is saying here is that, God, your knowledge protects me. How so? Because God knows, remember Matthew 6, the Lord Jesus says your Father knows what you need even before you ask him, because he knows all things and because he knows your particular need, that knowledge then results in action on your behalf. God's knowledge fuels his actions on your behalf. How do you know that? Well, look at the rest of that verse, verse 5, and you have put your hand upon me. Again, beloved, this is beautiful language. Hand there is the word for cupped. The Lord Jesus, the psalmist is saying, yeah, you have placed your palm over me. Now think about that. When do we cup our hands? When you have an insect that's weak, right? That's lost its leg and you're trying to save that insect, or perhaps a small bird that's dropped out of its nest that can't fly, or maybe it's a flame that's just flickering or smoldering and it needs to burn. And so what does this tell you? This pictures protection, but it also pictures provision. Because hand in the Bible is an image of blessing. So, for example, in Genesis 48, when Jacob blessed Joseph's sons, you learn that he laid his hand on Joseph's sons in order to bless them. And so I say again, when it says you have enclosed me, you have surrounded me, he's saying your knowledge is protecting me in the sense that because God knows what you need, he then provides you with what you need and he protects you within your need. So, in the words of Matthew 10, every what? Hair on your head has been numbered. You don't even know how many hairs on your head, but God does. In that passage, we learn that God knows when a sparrow falls to the ground. You don't know that. Do you know how many sparrows fell to the ground in Johannesburg yesterday? And that word for fall there, you can even translate hop. God knows when a sparrow hops, every time a sparrow hops. This is the extent of his knowledge. And so, beloved, you can be comforted by this. So do you see in Psalm 138, when David says in verse 8, the Lord will accomplish, not might accomplish, will perhaps accomplish. No, he will accomplish that which concerns me. Do you see that how his knowledge, his perfect knowledge, informs his actions and his provision and his protection on your behalf? So in these six verses, we are face to face with the perceiving God, the omniscient God, the all-knowing God. Beloved, perhaps you're here this morning and you're thinking, no one understands what I'm going through. And you don't even bother sharing your hurts or your needs with someone because you're thinking, they won't understand. Or perhaps you don't have someone to share with because you're lonely and you're isolated and you're alone. Well, God knows. He knows. Secondly, not only the perceiving God, but the pursuing God. The pursuing God. And this comes in verses 7 through 12. And what I'm going to argue for in these verses is that God is all present. Now, notice I didn't say the present God. I said the pursuing God. Because I'm going to show you from this text that God isn't just present in a passive way. No, he's present to, again, act on your behalf. He's present because he wants to pursue you. Because he wants to come after you in order to show himself strong on your behalf. And so I'm calling it the pursuing God, but you could say the present God. So this, if verses 1 through 6, if you want the theological word, is he's omniscient. In verses 7 through 12, he's omnipresent. He's omnipresent. He's the God who is all present. But I'm going to take it a step further and refer to him as the pursuing God. Let's read verses 7 through 12 and we'll again comment on them. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will bruise me and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark for you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. Verse 7 is a rhetorical question. Where can I go from your spirit? The implied answer is nowhere. Where can I flee from your presence? Again, the intended reply is nowhere. So this is a focus now, these verses, on God's presence. But as I'll show you in a moment, it's more than his presence. Now look at verse 8. If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. This is a reference to the supernatural realm. Heaven is clear, and we've spoken about Sheol before, the place of the dead. And really what the psalmist is trying to do here is to portray for you vertical extremities, meaning the highest place and the lowest place and everything in between. And he's saying, I can't go higher than heaven and I can't go lower than Sheol. And so, and nowhere in between, you are there. So this here is a reference to the supernatural realm. What the psalmist is going to do here is cover the bases again. He's wanting, remember, this is poetry. But he's trying to show you how vast and extensive, in this case, the presence of God is. Look at verse 9. If I take the wings of the dawn. Now think about that. That represents the east. He's now going to speak about the natural realm. The sun rises in the east. And so now he's going to speak of horizontal extremities. And the implication here is from east to west and everything in between. And then notice, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea. And so this is travel language, of course, And what he's saying here is, wherever I go from point A to point B and everything in between, you are there. Whether I'm on land, whether I take a ship and go on sea, wherever I go, my point of departure and my point of destination and everything in between, you are there. Now, remember, I said to you, I'm calling this section the pursuing God. He is present. He is all present. He is omniscient, but he's not merely a spectator. Listen, yesterday you may have watched some sports and there were spectators in the crowd and they were present, but they were not in the game. They weren't playing. And what the psalmist is going to show us now is that God is not just in the stands. He's on the field and he's got your back. So look what he says in verse 10, even there, even if I were to go to the remotest part of the sea, even there, your hand will lead me. You see, God is not passive. He's not an innocent bystander. He's an active participant. Lead there is the word that was used when Israel was redeemed from Egypt and God led them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. See how active this is? God is leading him. God is showing him the way. And then, look at the rest of verse 10. And there, even there, your right hand will lay hold of me. That word there, lay hold of. Remember when Jacob and Esau came out of, during their time of birth? What was Jacob doing? He was holding on to Esau's heel. This is the word here. See how active that is? And the psalmist is saying, God is holding on to me. So do you see, beloved, it's not just that he's present. He's present to lead you. He's present to take hold of you. So I say he's not just the present God, he's the pursuing God. He comes after you. He's the hound of heaven who chases after you, not to harm you, but to show you favor, to deliver you, to rescue you, to help you. So if verse 8 is a reference to the supernatural realm where he's present, if verses 9 and 10 is a reference to the natural realm like the earth and the sea, verses 11 and 12 now is going to be the experiential realm, or if you like, the personal realm. Look at what he says. Now, the translation I have before me says, if I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, that's okay. That's legitimate. But the word there is the word for pain. And so the Legacy Standard Bible, rightly or more narrowly, translates that surely the darkness will bruise me. Bruise me. If you get a pain, if you get a bruise, usually that means you got a bump, right? You got an ow. You were hit by or with something. And then look at the rest of verse 11. And the light around me will be night. Even the darkness is not too dark for you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. So darkness and light here, again, remember this is poetry. This is a reference to circumstances, the psalmist's personal circumstances. In other words, dark times, times of pain, times of sorrow, times that are inexplicable, when you don't understand, when you can't see ahead of you. And light then would be times of blessing, times of favor, times of understanding and growth. How do you know that? Well, as I said, the word there is bruise. Your darkness will bruise me. And what does the psalmist say in Psalm 23? Even though I were to walk in the valley of the shadow of death, but you can translate that legitimately a valley of deep darkness. It's the word for fog-like conditions. You can't see ahead of you. And in the psalmist's day, you had cliffs, as the psalmist, as the shepherd would move sheep from one grazing field to another. Oftentimes they would go through a narrow valley that was flanked by cliffs. And because you had these high cliffs in a narrow valley, as the sun, even in the day, shone on this, it would create a shadow. But it was darker in the valley, and the sheep, their eyesight isn't great to begin with anyway, but predators hid in the form of animals, hid in those dark valleys because they knew the sheep were more vulnerable and they could pounce on the sheep. Animals did, but so did human predators, thieves and robbers. They hid there so that they could steal sheep and rob the shepherd and even kill the shepherd. So what the psalmist is saying in Psalm 23 is, even though I go through a valley that potentially is a life-threatening circumstance, a valley that is so dark, morally, spiritually speaking, that I can't see ahead of myself, it's fog-like conditions, what is he saying? I will fear no evil or injury or harm, for thou art with me. This is the sense that darkness and light is used here. No matter what your circumstances, favorable or unfavorable, times of light or times of darkness, times of confusion and times of perception, times of understanding or times of enigmas, complexities, mysteries. He's saying that God is there with him. And God will lead him. And God's right hand will take a hold of him. Is that not comforting? Do you see now, again back to Psalm 138? The Lord will accomplish what concerns me. Whose idea was it for the sheep to move through this narrow valley? The shepherd's. The shepherd led them through the valley. It was the shepherd's idea. It was the shepherd's plan. And so you might go through this valley of deep darkness, and you may be tempted to be afraid, and you may not know what tomorrow holds, but he does. And even if the predators were to come, his rod and his staff will protect you, for he has the power to, even in the very presence of your enemies, prepare a table for you. So, beloved, you see how that you don't have to fret over your life. He will accomplish that which concerns you. He will. Does the psalmist say, I will fulfill God's purposes? Does the psalmist say in 138:8, I will accomplish God's plan for my life? No. The Lord will, Yahweh will. So that's the second component of the psalm, verses 7 through 12, is not only the perceiving God, verses 1 through 6, is not only the pursuing God in verses 7 through 12. Thirdly, he's also the planning God, or if you like, the purposeful God. The planning God. Let's read verses 13 through 18 and I'll elaborate on what I mean by planning God. Verse 13, you formed my inward parts. You wove me. Notice again the personal pronouns. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unshaped substance, and in your book all of them were written, the days ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. How precious are your thoughts to me, O God? How vast is the sum of them? If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I'm still with you. By planning God here, I mean that he's the all-powerful God. He's not only the omniscient God, verses 1 through 6. He's not only the omnipresent God, verses 7 through 12. He also is the omnipotent God, the all-powerful God. But in his power, he predicts. In his power, he plans. In his power, he predestines. So, look at verse 13. For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. And so he hearkens back to the time as a fetus, if you like, in his mother's womb. And the word wove there is the word for stitching, embroidery, or sewing. And so he's saying that you sewed me, as it were. We'll see how that this connects with your life in a moment. You knitted me, you sewed me, you wove me, you embroidered me in my mother's womb. And what the psalmist is going to develop here, his argument is going to be that God is the master artist. God is the master craftsman of your life. God is the master embroiderer, if you like. Notice, I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully, and when it says wonderfully made, that's a great word. It means differently, it means uniquely, it means distinctly, which is true, right? None of us have the two same set of fingerprints. You're unique, and what he's going to argue, I'll just spill the beans and come back to it. What he's going to argue in a moment is that your life is unique. God's plan for you is distinct from everybody else. And he's going to argue in the verses that follow, from the womb to the tomb, from the cradle to the grave, from being hatched to being dispatched, God has personally knitted together your life, every facet of your life. The rest of verse 14, wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. Continuing with this imagery of in your mother's womb, my frame, meaning your skeleton, my frame was not hidden from you. Your skeleton and your muscles and your tendons and everything about you was not hidden from you. When I was made in secret, and notice, intricately woven, same word for woven in verse 13, embroidered, knitted together. And that word for intricately, there's the word for skillfully. Skillfully woven in the depths of the earth. The earth, there's a metaphor for the unseen, right? Your mother's womb. So that's the womb. But what he's going to do now in verse 16 is going to argue that this does not only extend to birth, but it extends to your life. Look at verse 16. Your eyes have seen my unshaped substance. And in your book, all of them were written, the days. Now, my translation that I read from has ordained, but the Legacy Standard Bible has formed, and I like that. Because you can, even though it is technically a different word to form in verse 13, you formed my inward parts, but you can still translate that word as formed in verse 16. And I think they're trying to make the connection. The days, notice that, were formed for me when as yet there was not one of them. That word there, obviously in the Legacy Standard Bible, I just said is formed. The ESV also has formed. The NIV and the New American Standard has ordained, just to help you appreciate this word and to try and help wrap the arms of your mind around this word. The New King James Version has fashioned, which is similar to formed, right? But the Holman Christian Standard Bible has planned. So, beloved, notice. He's saying here, God, yes, you saw my unformed substance when I was in my mother's womb. You were the one providentially knitting me together in my mother's womb, but you not only formed me in my mother's womb, you also formed the days that would follow my birth. You fashioned all of them. They were written in your book. You planned my days. So let's just put it this way, beloved. God planned that on the 3rd of October, 2021, you would, from 9 a.m. to 11:15 a.m., be seated at Grace Christian Church. And he knew when you sat down and he knew when you stood up. But he planned from eternity past that you would be sitting here today, that you'd be worshiping here today. Just like he planned last Tuesday. And just like if you're still alive, if he doesn't take you, if he doesn't return, he will plan the 20th of February, 2022 for you. And the 16th of August, 2025 for you. Now, does this not comfort you? So again, I say, look at 138:8, the Lord will accomplish what concerns me. Does God ever fail? No. Does God accomplish what he sets out to accomplish? Yes. So if he has planned your days, if he has formed your days, if he has fashioned your days, do you think it'll come to pass exactly, intricately, remember? Intricately woven, skillfully woven. Do you think it will come to pass exactly as he has planned? Yes. So therefore, by the theme of Ecclesiastes, I say to you again, live without regret. Sorry, live without reserve, die without regret. Live your life to the full. He's planned it. In a sense, you cannot fail. So relax. Cut yourself some slack, as the Americans would say. Now in verse 17, remember in verse 2 when I said you understand my thought, and I said it's the word even for intentions or motives. So look at verse 17. He says, how precious are your, you could say there, your intentions. And 2, you could translate 4 very legitimately. How precious are your intentions for me, O God? See, this is what the psalmist is meditating on. When he thinks about the fact that God has ordained his days, that God has planned his days, and it's for his well-being, right? All things work together for good to those who love God. When he therefore meditates on it, he says, oh God, how precious are your intentions for me? I'm amazed. You're not just present, but you pursue me. You want to take hold of me with your right hand. You want to lead me wherever I am. It's not just that you know all about me, but your knowledge protects me in the sense that your knowledge provides for me. Because you know what I need, you will therefore provide for me. So when I think about your intentions for me, it's precious thoughts. For me, my meditations. How vast, end of verse 17, is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I'm still with you. Why with you? Because God's all present, right? Verses 7 through 12. But he's not just present. He's present to show himself strong on your behalf. He's present to work all things for your good, according to Romans 8. And so, he never leaves you. He says, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. Now, beloved, is this not comforting? I ask you again. Not only is he all-knowing, not only is he all-present, not only is he all-powerful, But these attributes of His, these perfections of His, are personal as it relates to you if you're a believer. So let me ask you, if this is all true, and it is, what then is one of the greatest sins that you and I can be guilty of? Think about that. If God is all-knowing and His knowledge encompasses you, besieges you, and if God is all-present in the sense that He even pursues you, even if you're in the remotest part of the sea, and if He has planned your days, what then is one of the greatest sins that you and I can be guilty of? Amen and amen. Anxiety. Worry. Stress. Anxiety. Not an unforgivable sin. It's not the unforgivable sin, but I mention that because this is what the psalmist is going to ask God to now search him for. Because he knows this, does the psalmist. But he also knows that he's still a sinner and that he can be tempted by anxiety. So now in verses 19 through 24, you're going to learn about the pure God. If God is all holy in verses 1 through 6, if God is all present in verses 7 through 12, if God is all powerful in verses 13 through 18, then in verses 19 through 24, God is all holy. All holy. So let me read it and then we'll comment on it. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Oh, men of bloodshed, depart from me, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Yahweh, and do I not revile those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. So here you see something of God's holiness. Remember, I've been saying to you that some of these imprecatory aspects of the Psalms can be hard in our ears. But David is zealous for the holiness of God and the purposes of God to prevail and for God's name to be exalted. And notice this again, it's got nothing to do with personal vengeance. So look at verse 19. He doesn't say, give me strength to slay the wicked. No, he says, oh, that you, he leaves vengeance to the Lord. Oh, that you would slay the wicked. But understanding that, he says, oh, men of bloodshed, this is men of violence, depart from me. And now you see what drives this motive of David. It's the honor of Yahweh. Notice verse 20, for they speak against you wickedly. Lord, they're dragging your name and your reputation through the mud. Lord, they're dishonoring you. Notice your enemies. They are God's enemies. They take your name in vain. They don't serve your purposes, O God. They reject your purposes. Now, the word in verse 21 for hate is the word to reject. So you and I can appreciate that. That's how that word is used. So we can think of it that way. Do I not reject those who reject you, O Yahweh? The word is hate. That is the word. I'm just telling you it's used in a context of rejection and acceptance. So that's one way for your mind and my mind to think of this, because we don't live in this day and this is harsh in our ears. He says, do I not reject those who reject you? And then when he says in this next line now, he helps to explain that, do I not revile those or loathe those? This is to be sickened by. He says, Lord, those who rise up against you, those who rebel against you, those who don't dishonor you, their actions make me sick. It's right for you to feel this way. Now, you don't stop there, right? You pray for their salvation. You evangelize them when you have opportunity. You do come to this point, though, where you pray that God will intervene and judge. But I'm just saying to you, if you are sick by what you see around you, that's honoring to God, because you should feel sick because God loathes it. God abhors evil and violence and bloodshed and lies and injustice and oppression and sin of all kinds. This is David. So you can identify with David. He says, I'm sickened by them. And then he says, now notice in verse 20, your enemies, second line in verse 20, take your name in vain. And then look at the end of verse 22, they have become mine enemies. See, they are my enemies, Lord, because they are first your enemies. And I love what you love and I hate what you hate. And because they are your enemies, they've become my enemies. And so you are really aligning yourself with the heart of God and the purposes of God. So David understood and appreciated something of God's holiness. But see, David, in his desire for God's name to be honored and for God's purposes to prevail and flourish, he understands that if that is to happen, God must deal with evil. But he also understands not only the evil out there, but the evil what? In here. Your own personal evil. Your own personal sin. And so look at what he then comes to in verse 23. Search me. Notice me. You see that? Not my wife. Not my children. Not my church leaders. Not my government leaders, not my boss, no, search me. Oh God, and know my heart. And then he says, and this is parallel with search me and know me, try me. And that is an instructive word because it's a metallurgical word. It was used in those days to heat metals, to apply the heat so that the dross would rise to the surface of the metal, and then they would skim the dross, and then they would increase the heat so that if there were any other impurities left, that would come to the surface, and they could remove that in an attempt to refine and purify this metal. And in those days, maybe not today, I don't know, but definitely in those days, the silversmith would know that the metal is pure when he could see his reflection on the surface of the metal. But beloveds, notice what he's saying. Lord, increase the search of my heart. And I left this to this moment to tell you this, but before I expand on the rest of verse 23. Go to verse 1 again. Oh, Yahweh, you've what me? Searched me, right? And now, what did you do in verse 23 and 24, which is connected? What me? Search me. In poetry, and this is what the Hebrew writers employed, this is called inclusio, meaning these are two bookends, meaning that the meaning of the psalm must be interpreted in light of search me. This is what the psalmist is leading to. This is the apex. This is the crescendo. This is the climax. He understands because of who this God is, who is worthy of worship, whose name ought to be exalted, that he better be right with this God. And so the cry of his heart is, search me, try me. Now think about that, beloved. What is he praying for you? Is he saying, Lord, heal me? Is he saying, Lord, secure my bank account? Lord, give me a great job? Lord, bless my marriage. Now, I don't want to make light of those things. Those are real needs. And you can honor God in those areas of life and you can add to that list. But I just want you to see that for the psalmist, those were secondary. What is primary is that he's right with this holy God. And so the cry of his heart is, he says in verse 1, notice in the past you have searched me, but Lord, that's what you've done yesterday. You need to search me today. You have searched me, but I need you to continue to search me and try me. Because from yesterday to today, I've sinned again. I've blown it again. But notice what he says. Try me and know my what? Anxious thoughts. Anxious thoughts. That word there for anxious thoughts is also used in Psalm 94 and verse 19. There the psalmist says, when my anxious thoughts multiply. Now listen. If you struggle with anxiety, if you're anxious here this morning, or if you have struggled with anxiety, be encouraged. The psalmist says in Psalm 94, when my anxious thoughts multiply, meaning it was possible for the psalmist, which means it's possible for you. You're not immune from the temptation of anxiety. He says, when my anxious thoughts multiply within me, Psalm 94, 19, your consolations delight my soul. So there's another place where this word is used for anxious thoughts. Some translations has disquieting thoughts, meaning uneasiness, uneasy thoughts, disturbing thoughts. But it's so strong, this word, that one commentator, Alan P. Ross, describes this anxiety as crippling anxiety. Golding Gay is another commentator. He interprets this word to mean a consuming anxiety. So this could be the experience for a believer. It's possible that you have yielded to this temptation, but I just want you to think about this, beloved. In light of what you now know about God and have been reminded about Him in verses 1 through 18, that He's all-knowing, that He's all-present, that He's all-powerful. You and I really have no need to be anxious, but yet we can be, and so the psalmist, out of all the sins, he asked God to really hone in on this one. Lord, the impurities of anxiety, turn up the heat, Lord. Crank up the heat, Lord, so that the impurities of anxiety can rise, spiritually speaking, to the metal of my spiritual life so that you can then skim it off as you grant me forgiveness. Now, I think you know probably by personal experience that anxiety, as we saw, it can be consuming, it can be crippling, but as a result, it can also be damaging or devastating. So look at what he says in verse 24. And see, and this is parallel to verse 23, and see if there be any, what, hurtful way in me. That phrase, the hurtful way, literally is way of pain. He's saying, show me, Lord, see within my heart if there's any sin in my life right now that's causing me pain. That's a consequence of my sin that has a destructive, damaging, detrimental impact on my spiritual life and my physical life. Lord, I want to confess that. I want to repent of that. So show me this, Lord. But I want you to see here, beloved, anxiety is not only real, it is powerful, it can bring pain. And then he says, and lead me. Remember verse 10, right? Even there, your right hand, even there, your hand will lead me. Now, that same word he's saying here, after you've done this, Lord, after you've searched my heart, after you've shown me my heart, after you've tried my heart, and after I've, implication is, confessed that sin to you and repented of that sin, experienced your familial forgiveness again, Lord, I thank you that I've experienced your forensic forgiveness, but I need to experience your familial forgiveness, right? Now, Lord, lead me in the everlasting way. Now, I believe that's in contrast to hurtful way, the way of pain. So if the way of pain is a way of sin that leads to pain, then the everlasting way must mean the way of righteousness, right? And in Psalm 23, what do we read there? That the good shepherd will lead us in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And the psalmist in Psalm 31:3 says, for your name's sake, you will lead, same word, and guide me. Or if you like, if you think of this anxiety, if you think about this disquieting, these disquieting thoughts, these disturbing thoughts, these uneasy thoughts, what's the opposite of that? Peace. Shalom. Peace. That wholeness, that completeness, that contentedness. And the Bible speaks of that. In fact, there's a psalm that says righteousness and peace have kissed together. And so the way, the everlasting way, meaning, if you think about if it's going to be everlasting, there's no sin in heaven, right? If this is going to be everlasting, it has to be the way of righteousness. But I think we can also add here, if you put all the other psalms together, the way of peace. So, beloved, in closing, let me make two comments. One is, you and I, we want the leading of God, right? We pray for the leading of God in our lives personally and even for our loved ones. But notice, isn't this psalm instructive? Because what comes before the leading? The searching and the trying. And that can be very painful. This is the refiner's fire. So don't expect to be led before you searched and tried. See, that's the leading, that's comfortable. We're thankful for that. We're not so thankful for the searching and the trying, but it's necessary. Secondly, if this whole psalm basically is about searching, right? This inclusio, verse 1, you've searched me, and now verse 23, search me. If you think about these four aspects of God, and just practically, here's what this should mean for you and I, besides the sin of anxiety or stress or worry. If you take that first six verses that God is all-knowing, so yeah, I'm going to give you some motives now that should encourage you as you pursue Christ and holiness. What you really should be asking God to search you for is the thoughts I thought. I no longer think, right? If God knows your thoughts and your intentions, then practically, by way of holiness, you shouldn't be thinking the way you thought before you became a believer. You should now be thinking God's thoughts after him. Your worldview now must be a biblical worldview shaped by God's truth. Secondly, if you think of that second aspect, God is all present. What should that indicate to you? The places I used to go to, I no longer go. Why? Because God is present there. The immoral places, the ungodly places, the places where God's name's not honored, the places I used to go to, I no longer go. Because I understand that God is all present. Thirdly, in terms of the planning God, right? The purposeful God, the all-powerful God, how should that challenge you? The plans I used to make, I no longer make. It's thy will, not my will be done. I crucify my dreams, my aspirations, my longings. I lay them at the feet of the cross. My rights, because you are now my master. I'm now your slave. You are my Lord. You are my King. I will bow down to you. I will pay homage to you and to your will for my life. So the plans I used to make, I no longer make. And then finally, here in verses 19 through 24, right, in terms of God's holiness, look, what does he say? Middle of verse 19, or end of verse 19, O men of bloodshed, depart from me. What should that look like in your life? The companions I used to have, I no longer have. The immoral ones, the ungodly ones, those who take God's name in vain, those who rise up against him. 1 Corinthians 15, bad company corrupts good morals. The word for company there is the word for a sermon, for message, for content, what people say, people's ideologies, their beliefs, what spews forth from their mouth. You're influenced by that. And so the psalmist says, the company I used to keep, I no longer keep. And from other psalms, we know now, my companions are those who fear you. So, beloved, may this psalm comfort you on the one hand in the days ahead because of who God is, but may it also convict you and I in light of who he is. We shouldn't be anxious for nothing, right? That's why Paul can say in Philippians 4, be anxious for nothing. And we should be pursuing holiness because God knows what you think. God knows where you are. And God knows who your companions are.